mention this particular phrase that you see here, because this occurs a number of places in the suttas with slightly different phrasing. Sometimes they say no first point of existence can be found, sometimes no first point of ignorance. It's phrased in slightly different ways. But in some traditions or some lineages of Buddhism, you find that it says there is no first point of ignorance, right? So you can see how easily you make that jump from no first point can be seen to there is no first point. And this is often how people read this. When they read it, think, oh, there's no first point of ignorance. But that's not actually what it says. It says no first point of ignorance can be seen. And there is a massive difference between that. And it shows you a little bit about how Buddhism works. The idea is not to make some kind, if you say that there is no first point, how can you know that? How can you know, to be able to know that, you would have to go back in time or something and see that first point. That's really probably the only way you could do it. Maybe it's possible to do it through inference or deduction, I don't know. But what the Buddha is saying here is that as far as I have gone back in time, and the Buddha is supposed to have recalled a long, long time into the past, as far as I can see, I cannot see any first point. So it's a purely empirical statement about what you actually have seen and what you haven't seen. And this is very different from a lot of other philosophies or religion in the world, where the idea of showing a starting point is like one of the foundations of most religions, right? You have the Genesis, chapter of Genesis in the Old Testament, which is all about how Genesis means arising, right? Coming into existence, that's what the word Genesis means. And the arising, coming into existence of the world is what it describes in there. And the majority of religions have that. You know, Hinduism, exactly the same thing. There's all these mythologies about how things come into existence. And I think it is probably part of our human nature. We want kind of solutions to these things. And then the Buddha says, actually, there is no first point. And at the first of all, you think, oh, I would like to know what's going on. I'd like to know the first point. It's a bit unsettling that there is no first point. But it actually makes very good sense. To me, it makes eminent good sense that no first point can be found. If there is a first point, you always have a further question, why is that the first point? And then they try to find the solutions, and the solutions they have to something being the first point are always inadequate. A God created it. Okay, so what about this God then? Where does this God come from? And if the God has always been there, why hasn't existence always been there? What's the difference? You get into these conundrums, which are really unexplainable. So this is one of those fundamental things, again, which I think is so, to me, very powerful about Buddhist teachings. It avoids some of these pitfalls that, to me, appear to exist in other teachings, other religions, perhaps, other philosophies, or whatever it is. So no first point. Even science gets it wrong, according to Buddhism, right? Science says it begins at the Big Bang. Yeah. But Buddhism doesn't say that. Buddhism says it goes beyond that as well. So again... Okay, so no ignorance, right? Ignorance goes back. And of course, the interesting point here as well is that ignorance is here really a synonym for existence. There is no first point for existence. So existence and ignorance are, so closely related. If there is ignorance, avidya, there is existence. If there is no ignorance, no avidya, there is no existence. So these two things go together into the past, as far back as you possibly can. There is another sutta, actually, just after this one, which is number 62 of the tens, and that takes this one step further back and says that what does ignorance itself cause? What is the step beyond ignorance? And that is craving for existence, right? So craving for existence is caused by ignorance. As long as you don't understand reality as it actually is, you will crave existence. The sense of self says, I want to exist, I want to go on. And then you keep on traveling, keep on going on and on and on. So craving for existence is derived from this. Once ignorance is dispelled, craving for existence stops. It's interesting, isn't it? It's kind of almost hard to comprehend. How can craving for existence completely disappear? That is what it basically says. Okay, so ignorance has always been there, and yet still, despite that, please feel free to ask questions as we go along. If you don't understand a word of what I'm saying, please raise your hand and ask it, because sometimes I may not, I may speak too fast or say things that you can't really grasp, so please let me know. Still, ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. So it has always been there, right? You go back, and yet it has a condition, which is interesting. So how does this work out? So let's have a look at the very first line of the next one, just to understand what is meant by this. I say, Bhikkhus, that ignorance has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment for ignorance? It should be said, the five hindrances. So this gives you, so the five hindrances are this specific condition for ignorance, right? Now, one of the first things to note here, which is kind of interesting, the first paragraph talks about specific condition, and then here we talk about nutriment suddenly here. So how come this change of vocabulary from going from specific condition to nutriment? Because usually the Buddha tends to be very consistent. He uses the same terminology throughout. He doesn't kind of jump around using different terminology. In the Pali, the words are also very different. And the first one, specific condition, is usually related to dependent origination, whereas nutriment is often used a bit more broadly. I don't know, but to me it looks a little bit like what may have happened here is that two things are kind of been tacked together, right? Why this different vocabulary? So maybe the first part there was kind of added later on because maybe somebody thought that it kind of would fit in well with the sutta. It's just a hypothesis. I have no idea whether that actually is the case or not, but it's one way in which this kind of thing can happen, that you have this kind of rather unusual change of terminology here. So, the important point here is that ignorance has a nutriment, avidya has a nutriment, right? Now, first of all, the idea of nutriment itself is quite interesting, because a nutriment suggests more than just a condition. It is a kind of a specific type of condition. A nutriment is something that nourishes, right? That can make something either grow, or if it's weak, it can make something wither, depending on the strength of that nutriment. So this is what we are seeing here all through this particular sutta. We're seeing this idea of something either being nourished or not properly nourished. Or, if you take the nutriment entirely, then, of course, that thing will eventually die out as a consequence. So nutriment here has this quite specific idea, a specific type of conditionality, not just any type of conditionality. There are other types of conditionality where simply one thing exists, therefore something else exists, right? There's no real nutrition going on, but here is its nutrition, the idea of giving strength. So by weakening one, you're weakening the other. By strengthening one, you're strengthening the other, etc. And so this is how the five hindrances are a condition for avidya. They're not a condition in the sense that they are an absolute condition. When the five hindrances are there, avidya is there. When the five hindrances are gone, avidya or delusion is gone. No, it's more like this kind of support condition, which enables it either to grow or to diminish. And what that means is that in your ordinary life, as long as the five hindrances are decreasing in general, right, or at least not increasing, it means you're not nourishing the avidya, the ignorance, or the delusion. So this is why this path of Buddhism is often called the path of purification. The idea is that as you purify yourself, you reduce the defilements, you reduce all the five hindrances. Ignorance, because we're trying to become wise here, so ignorance or delusion is diminishing as a consequence of that. Until one day the five hindrances are completely gone. And at that point, there is no nourishment anymore at all for delusion or for lack of understanding. The nourishment is gone. It means that the avidya is very weak at that particular point. Right? So this is the idea here. You weaken that avidya, so it is kind of ready to kind of do the final little, little thing to make it kind of disappear altogether. And it is good to reflect in your own life how this works, because this is actually very practical, and it's very easy to see how this works in your own life. And you know, when you feel like your mind is very clouded, right? You feel that you are maybe you're upset about something, or you have desires about something, and or you are tired, or you're really feeling really slothful, or restless, or whatever it is, and you can feel that the mind isn't right. The mind isn't really clear. It's very easy to know that. You can know when your mind is clear and when it isn't. And basically, you know, when you have that lack of clarity and your mind is kind of full of all these hindrances or whatever, you know that there is a kind of delusion there. You know, you cannot really make good decisions. You feel that you are kind of all over the place. And of course, the reality is that you should not make decisions at that particular point, because they're going to be bad decisions. I think it's one of those very important and very practical things in life that if you want to make good decisions, wait till you feel a sense of clarity. If you know that your mind is kind of confused or has all kind of defilements, just wait, just chill, sit back, relax, go on a retreat, do whatever, until you gain a sense of clarity, and then ask yourself, what should I be doing here? Sure, you can't always do that, because sometimes decisions need to be made, but if it's like an important decision in life, then it is always good to wait with such decisions. And I found in myself, in my own life, sometimes when you kind of get overwhelmed by defilements. Defilements are very compelling, right? Upset says, act now, this person needs to be told off, you need to do this. These powerful driving forces, craving and ill will and desires are very closely related to each other. They compel you to act, especially desire definitely compels you to act. Yes, I have to have this, I must have it now, I can't wait. So it actually is quite difficult to wait, quite difficult to just relax, quite difficult to just sit back and wait for these things to pass, because they are such compulsive forces. And I'm sure that this is what habits come from, right? We always acted on the anger in the past, so now you are in that habit of doing this. And you need to hold yourself back and say, wait, I don't really know what's going on. I'm confused, I'm in a state of delusion. I have no idea what's happening. Please don't, this is the wrong time to act. This is the wrong time to kind of say something or whatever it is. And then you start to be able to make really good decisions in life. And of course, those good decisions in life, they in turn support your spiritual practice. Because when you make good decisions, you make them aligned with the Dhamma, aligned with his teachings, in line with the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? And then things tend to go so much more smoothly here as a consequence. So keep that in mind, and as you do that, you can sort of see how your delusion, your ignorance, your avidya is increasing or decreasing together with these five hindrances. But if the five hindrances are the nutriment to avidya, why is it that when you make a complete end of those five hindrances, right? Temporarily, you get into a nice state of samadhi, think, whoa, so how wonderful. And the reason why it is so wonderful is precisely because the hindrances aren't there, right? It just feels so good to be free of these things. So if these are the support for delusion and avidya, why is it that you don't become awakened? Why don't you become an arahant at that moment when these are gone? And the reason is that precisely what we've been talking about before, these are a nutriment, they're not an absolute condition. There's another condition that is required, and that other condition is a view. The view has to be right as well. Or not just that the view has to be right, but there has to be an absence of wrong view. That's perhaps a better way of looking at it. The absence of wrong view, so you have like an open mind about things, then you can investigate in the right way, and then you can break through. And it's interesting, when you read the suttas broadly, you see, for example, in the Satipatthana Sanghita, Satipatthana all about the four focuses of mindfulness, right? That's how Ajahn Brahm translates Satipatthana. And what it says in there, all the way through, is that you practice that Satipatthana based on two things. And those two things is sila. Sila means habit, virtue, morality, character. That is like the five hindrances. Right? You get rid of the five hindrances, and this is like when you are really, really virtuous in a very profound sense. So sila is one, and the other one is view. You have you have to have ujjuka ditti. Ujjuka means straight view. I think the word ujju is directly etymologically related to right or upright in English. Upright, upright view, rectitude, right? So this view, these words are exactly the same. These are the two things, and these are the two things that are required here as well. Once you have those two things in place, then it becomes possible. If not, if you come to the end of the five hindrances and you think, wow, what bliss, but you have some kind of view which blocks you from seeing things. You know, the typical one is, oh yeah, I found God or something like that. And this is usually what happens at this stage because of the power of the experience. You think, if there is a God, this is it, I have found God. Then that will block you and that will stop you from going any further. So you have to have the right attitude and then you can make the breakthrough. And the rest of the sutta, so this is now about how do we get to this point of having that right attitude and that freedom from these defilements at the beginning there. What the rest of the sutta is about. And we will go back stage by stage, cause condition by condition, and see where this gets us. Anybody has any questions so far? There's often a big mix of people in a crowd like this. Some people are really, you know, a beginner. Some have been here, some know, you know, almost as much as I do about this sutta. So it's kind of a big mix. So please don't feel shy about asking if you are confused, because sometimes you get intimidated when you see all these other people who know so much. And you please don't feel intimidated. Okay, so let us have a look at all these causes and conditions. So the next one, of course, is the five hindrances too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the five hindrances? It should be said the three kinds of misconduct. Let me just read out the whole thing and then take them stage by stage afterwards, so you have some idea what's happening here. The three kinds of misconduct too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of the three kinds of misconduct? It should be said non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties too, I say, have a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment? It should be said lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension too, I say, has a nutriment. And what is that? Careless attention. Careless attention too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is that nutriment? It is lack of faith or confidence. And what is the nutriment for the lack of faith? It should be said not hearing the good Dhamma. And what is the nutriment for not hearing the good Dhamma? It should be said not associating with good persons. Okay, so that is the basic series. And now I will go back to the beginning, so you can turn the page back again if you wish. So now we'll have a look at these things in a bit more detail. But it's a very interesting series, right? Not a series you are used to seeing in the suttas. And it has all kind of little implications when the Buddha kind of does things in a different way. One thing I should say as well, which I didn't mention, is that this sutta also exists in Chinese as well. And the Chinese version is almost exactly the same as the Pali version. The only difference with the Chinese version in terms of the sequence here is that it has Kalyanamitta between not hearing the good Dhamma and associating with good persons. So it adds the idea of Kalyanamitta in there. And I think that's fine. I don't think it makes any difference whether you have it or not. Good persons and Kalyanamitta are anyway pretty synonymous. So again, it's one of those things that to me is very powerful when these ancient suttas that have been separated for so long, right? 2,300 years of separation, and you compare them now and they're almost exactly the same. It gives you this strong confidence that we actually have the word of the Buddha in the present day here. I find it almost astonishing that these similarities are so great, right? Out of such a long period. It's like, how is it possible? Human beings, we are so incredibly fallible. We make so many mistakes all the time. And yet somehow we've been able to preserve this sutta so well over such a long period. So remarkable achievement and remarkable to still be in the presence of the word of the Buddha in this way. It's very kind of powerful spine-tingling feeling almost. Okay. So what is the nutriment of the five hindrances? It's the three kinds of misconduct, right? So the three kinds of misconduct in the suttas are misconduct by body, speech, and mind, right? Body, speech, and mind. That is what is covered by morality, if you like, or covered by character or habit in the Buddhist teachings. So misconduct here is duccharita. Charita means literally movement or how you move around. So three ducharitas, right? So what the Buddha is basically saying here is that morality is what, lack of morality rather, immorality if you want, is what gives rise to the five hindrances. It's interesting because you might think, okay, I'm being kind by body, I'm avoiding all the bad, I don't go around killing people or stealing and that sort of stuff, and I try to do kind act by body, being generous and all this kind of things. It's not entirely obvious how that translates into the five hindrances, because one is like more like an external thing, the other one is an internal thing. Hindrances are internal, but it doesn't take much reflection to understand why there is a connection there. Because by keeping the precepts, sometimes you have to go against your habits. You have to go against what you would do if the precept hadn't been there. So by going against your habit, you are essentially reconditioning yourself. You're starting to look at the world in a different way. So your conduct actually does affect your mind. It does affect the hindrances as well. There's a connection there between the two. And also, what I also notice, if I really want to practice morality to the highest degree by being kind, doing the right things, I actually need to think differently, right? I need to think, what can I do to be kind in every moment of the day? What can I do to do something kind now? And often it means a change of attitude, a change of looking at the people around you. It's almost like changing your conduct forces you to think differently about things. You have no choice. Your perspective has to change. Your perception has to change. So just by being moral, by really trying hard and every moment of the day to do the right thing, you are actually changing your mind also in a very profound way at the same time. And the same thing with speech, right? Speech also exactly the same thing. If you always want to say nice things to other people, you have to think about people in a different way. You can't think they deserve to be told off. If you think like that, you're not going to be able to have a kind speech there. Your attitude changes as well. Habits change, your mental attitude change. All of these things go together. I'm not going to go into details about these things because that's for other suttas where they go into great detail about right speech and wrong speech. I would really recommend you to read about that. It's very beautiful the way this is described in the suttas. Like in Majjhima Nikaya 27, the shortest discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint, this is described in great detail. Or in the Salayaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 41, Majjhima 27 and 41, this is described in great detail. And it's very very inspiring, the way the Buddha talks about these things. Very, very nice to actually read up on that. And then there is the last kind of conduct, and that is more obvious. That is the conduct of the mind or the misconduct of the mind, right? I think it's fairly obvious that if you have misconduct of the mind, it's very similar to the five hindrances. Mental misconduct in the suttas is defined as ill will, very often very strong ill will, may these beings be slaughtered, that kind of stuff. So quite harsh ill will. Or it is defined as the desire, which is the covetousness. So strong desire, strong greed, wanting the possessions of others, right? Just a bit like in the Bible, the Ten Commandments, right? Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property or whatever it is. I don't really know how to say the commandments in English, but anyway, so I never learned that in English. I barely learned it in Norwegian, to be honest with you. But anyway, so something like that. It is strong desires, and of course, by reducing those desires directly in the mind, and by reducing the anger directly in the mind, by learning how to look at things differently, changing your perspective. And sometimes I feel, I don't know how you guys practice in lay life. It's almost difficult enough in monastic life, because in lay life you're always, it's much more difficult when you are surrounded by people all the time, and you have people around, you don't have enough distance sometimes. So it is very praiseworthy that you're able to practice well even in lay life. Of course, some of you have partners or you have families that think like you, which makes it much easier. But if you haven't got that, it can be quite hard. And then you need to kind of extract yourself sometimes, take a bit of time out to be able to get perspective on how you can change your perceptions to reduce these bad mental qualities. And then gradually over time, it changes. It's one of those remarkable things that I have noticed in my own life after being a monk now for 21 years or whatever it is. The change, right? The change over a long period of time is just astonishing. When you look at week to week or month to month, you can't see much change. But the cumulative effect over a long period of time is actually very powerful. Your whole attitude, your way of looking at things just changes completely. You feel like you're a bit like a new person. There's less delusion in the mind, more clarity. Everything kind of coming together. It's a wonderful thing when you see that happen. And if it doesn't happen in your life, you should ask yourself why, because there is a reason why it doesn't happen. Because this is really what should happen if you practice in the right way. And then it goes and it moves in the right direction. And you start, the more you see that, the more you understand, this is really what life is all about. What is the point of, you know, dying rich or dying with lots of possessions if your mind is just as confused or just as deluded as it was when you came into this world? That feeling of actually having changed yourself, wow, that has a sense of real purpose, a real sense of meaning of life. Everything else kind of fades in comparison to that. So that is the right or wrong conduct. And of course, one aspect, the third last aspect of the wrong conduct of mind is the right view, the right perspective. It is called here, it's not called Sammaditti in this particular place, actually. No, I haven't got it here. It's called, I think, the what's it called again? Something like, I think we could broadly translate as wrong perspective, basically the wrong way of looking at the world, right? And of course, when you look at that, you see there's things like having a sense of the idea of rebirth, at least not rejecting rebirth, having at the very least an open mind about these things, right? A sense that there are teachings, there are people in this world who have understood and seen profound things like the Buddha. If you haven't got that sense that there are people who have seen something profound, then, of course, you don't even get started. If you think that you are, I'm going to do everything by myself and nobody else knows more than I do, then, of course, it's going to be much more difficult for you. So that is about right view, and it creates that basis for you to be able to then find that solution at the end of the when the hindrances disappear, then that right view and those disappearance of the hindrances together, that is what makes it possible for you to make the breakthrough. So please keep your conduct right. It clears up the mind when you are kind. It clears up the mind when you avoid those bad things. Right? Isn't that a wonderful thing? It's kind of one of those things we often don't think about. We think about karma as something which happens in a future life somewhere. Well, I will reap the benefits of all the goodness I have done in this life. No, you reap that benefit right here, right now. And that is what is so beautiful about it. Every day, every time you're able to do an act of kindness, every time you avoid doing something wrong, you're lifting yourself up, quite literally, getting rid of the darkness, bringing light into your life, right? Isn't that wonderful? And it gives you a powerful incentive to actually be kind in this world, to do what is right. You take almost every opportunity. Every time you have a chance to say something nice, do something good, you take it because you know how powerful these things are. It kind of brings you out of all these problems and brings you towards a good solution, gradually. So there you are, right there, black on white, straight out of the mouth of the Buddha himself. Practice morality and you are heading in the right direction in a very good way. Yeah. John? Yes, in the Eightfold Path, usually there it talks about right view in the more profound sense of seeing the Four Noble Truths. So there is that kind of twofold idea of right view. One is like what you might call the right view of the Aryans, the noble ones, the people who have seen the Dhamma. And the other one is more like the general right view, which isn't the full right view. It's just a kind of general outlook, which is right. That's what is meant here in terms of the three types of right conduct. Yeah. So we talk about right conduct as a kind of lower right view. That's true. Okay. So that is the three kinds of nutriment. And so the question then is, what is the condition for these three kinds of misconduct, rather? What is the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct? And what does it say here? Non-restraint of the sense faculties. Right? So this non-restraint of the sense faculties is an interesting thing, that this is the cause for the three kinds of misconduct. The idea here, if you really want to purify your conduct to a very high degree, it means that you have to have a fairly even mind. You can't have a mind which allows itself to be pulled around by emotions all the time. If you get upset, right, or you get lots of desire, and kind of up and down, all through the day, no evenness, no kind of levelness of mind, it means that you can't be in control of that mind, because that mind is actually itself under the influence of these defilements. So you need to have that even mind, which has a sense of mindfulness about it, a sense of clarity about it. Only then is it possible to really have the three kinds of good conduct to the highest degree. We're here talking about very high degree of these things, right? We're talking about getting rid of the five hindrances. So the very high degree of the three kinds of good conduct or misconduct, depending on which way you turn this. So that is why the sense restraint is so important at this point, so that your mind is quite even. It's not being pulled around by the world so much. So what is this sense restraint? We talk about this in Buddhism a lot, and it is an important part of the Buddhist path. What does it actually mean? And I talked about this many times before, and I think this is a very important point. When we use the word restraint in English, it sounds like a very forceful thing, right? You have a restraining order and so on people. But restraint doesn't actually necessarily mean that. It can mean that in certain contexts. But normally, restraint here just means whatever thing you use to make sure that your mind is even, whatever method you use to make sure the mind isn't being pulled away by desires, by ill will, by aversions of the world. That is what is meant by restraint here. And the most powerful way of dealing with these things is actually wisdom. And I think Ajahn Brahm gets it spot on when he talks about wisdom power rather than willpower. I think that is exactly what the Buddha says too in the suttas. You look at the suttas, you see where the Buddha talks about these things in more detail, how to overcome bad thoughts, for example. The wisdom power, the way to deal, is always at the top, and the kind of using force always at the bottom. So the important ones are the wisdom power. Reflect on these thoughts in the right way. Understand them in the right way. Understand that they lead to suffering. Understand that they are problematic. And as you do that, they disappear all by themselves, right? There's that old simile, which I really like, which I think is very powerful in this case. It's just like the hot plate simile, right? You put your hand on the hot plate by accident, thinking it's cold, and then what happens? You just withdraw it automatically. And exactly the same way, if you know that things really lead to suffering and problems, you just withdraw your hand automatically. So it's worthwhile reflecting a bit on these things. Why is it that ill will is bad? Why is it problematic, right? And the more deeply you understand that, the less likely it is that you will get upset about things. Same thing with desires. If desires are problematic, then of course, again, you withdraw from that quite automatically. I'm not going to talk too much more about this, because this is a big subject in itself, and it's one of the things I really like to talk about, especially on retreats. Excuse me. Because it is such an important part of, I think, any Buddhist life, to learn how to think in such a way that you overcome problems. It's all about how we think, right? And the reason why it is so hard to change the way we think is because of habits, is because we've done this for such a long time. And as you gradually change that freight train with this massive momentum going in one direction, gradually change the direction, gradually, it takes a long time. But eventually, the habit becomes the exact opposite of what it used to be. The freight train now heading in the other direction instead. And you can't avoid thinking kind thoughts, right? May all beings be happy. Oh, I thought that again. Wow, happens automatically by itself. And this is kind of the idea. When you get into this habit of doing what is right, eventually it just happens. And you just do good, and it's actually difficult to do bad. Right? And for many people here, I'm sure that's the case already to some extent. But what a wonderful thing that is when that happens. You can't stop yourself from doing good acts. It just feels right at every step of the path. Okay, so non-restraint of the sense faculty. What is the nutriment for that? And it says here, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. And this is sati sampajanya in the Pali language. And the main thing which this is about is really about sampajanya is the main thing. Sati is here a kind of secondary thing. Sati in the sutta as mindfulness usually is about the four foundations or the four satipatthanas. That's basically what sati is about. And of course, satipatthanas really, they happen higher up on the path. They don't happen at this more basic level. So here, the main emphasis is on sampajanya, clear comprehension. Right? So you have to have clear comprehension to have sense restraint. What does that mean? Why is that? What is going on there? It's not very obvious. And what is going on is that the idea of clear comprehension, sampajanya, also translated as full awareness sometimes, is the basic idea is that you have an awareness of whether what you are doing in the moment is heading in the right direction. You have a sense of whether you are fulfilling the purpose of the path, whether you're doing the appropriate thing. That is what it's all about, right? So when you kind of walk here to the Dhammaloka Center, you think, yeah, this is sampajanya, I'm fulfilling the path by coming here. Or when you sit down to meditate, or when you say a kind word, in all of those instances, often you have a sense that, yes, I'm doing the right thing. You know, you can feel it inside of you. And that feeling that you're doing the right thing, that clarity about that, that is sampajanya. Other times you have a kind of uncomfortable feeling that you're heading off the path, you're not doing the right thing, right? You feel, well, is this, should I really be doing this? But you're too confused and too deluded to really know exactly what is going on. That is when sampajanya has kind of faded into the background. You don't really know what you're doing anymore. You don't have clarity whether you are fulfilling the purpose of this path. So sampajanya is this very broad category, and it includes almost any decision you make in your life, right? Whether it is conducive to the path or whether it's not. You always try to have this clarity about what you're doing, whether it's heading in the right direction. And of course, that is when sense restraint becomes possible, right? If you have clarity about everything, about how you think and about how you act, then that clarity will say, stop, heading in the wrong direction, don't go down that track, and then you will be able to restrain your senses as a consequence of that. So you need to have that sense of clarity about what's going on before sense restraint becomes possible. You know the purpose of every act you do. You know its suitability. Is it suitable for making progress on the path, right? And then you're okay. There's a lot more about sampajanya in the suttas, but I'm going to go through this fairly quickly this time, because this is a kind of sutta. It's so full of important things. You could talk about this for hours every day for a couple of weeks and still wouldn't exhaust a sutta like this. It's so pregnant with all kind of important things in there. So we have to do it fairly superficially, but not very superficially, of course, because you want to get the essence out of this. So what then is the condition for lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension? And then it has careless attention is the next one. Careless attention, ayoniso manasikara, is the Pali word. Sometimes translated as unwise reflection, the opposite of yoniso manasikara, which is wise reflection. So careless reflection. So what does careless or wise reflection, what does it actually mean? I know that it's so easy to think we understand these terms, right? Yeah, wise reflection, it means like being smart, being clever about things, not doing the wrong thing, right? That's what it means. And of course, we are kind of on the right track, but it's not really specific enough to really nail it down. What does it actually mean? Because once you have a fairly clear understanding, it's easier to practice these things once you have an understanding about these things. And it's in the Sabhasava Sutta, the second sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, you find that this idea of Yoniso Manasikara is actually defined in a very nice way. And there it is defined as whenever you think, whenever you do something, right, which leads you onwards on the path, which leads the, leads basically the good qualities in you to improve and the bad ones to decline. In other words, you're heading in the direction of the path. At that such a time, you have yoniso manasikara, you have wise reflection. And whenever you do something which takes you away from the path, leads you in the wrong direction, heads you on the wrongfold eightfold path, whatever you want to call it, the wrong noble eightfold or the ignoble eightfold path, then you are, it's ayoniso manasikara. So very simple. So you know every time defilement is increasing in your mind, ayoniso manasikara. Every time you're moving towards more clarity, yoniso manasikara. Very simple definition, which makes it clear what is meant by wisdom in the suttas. And this yoniso manasikara is one of these things that you have to take with you all the way along the path. Everywhere, it's always important. From the very beginning to the very end, yoniso manasikara is required. In the beginning, you need wise reflection or wise attention simply to get started, right? A lot of people hear the word of the Buddha and they just say, whatever, I'm not really interested in that sort of stuff, or they think it's completely wrong or whatever, right? That you don't even get started in that case. If we assume that the word of the Buddha is right, then they are on the wrong track and they have a problem. So it's necessarily at the very beginning. And you find that in the Anguttara Nikaya 1s, it says that one of the foundations of the entire path, which makes everything possible, one of those is yoniso manasikara, wise reflection. There's other things as well, like Kalyanamitta is another one, right? Having good friends. We'll come to that in a second. It's another one of those. Another one is appamada, not being heedless. Somebody is completely heedless, who doesn't really care, who does not careful about how they live their life. Of course, they're not even going to listen when we give them the teaching, because they don't care about that sort of thing. So these are some of those absolutely foundational things that are necessary for the path even to get started at all. And one of those is yoniso manasikara. And then you take that with you all the way along the path. Here it is placed in a particular position, but the reality is that you take it with you all the way along the path, always asking yourself this question, always knowing what is right, knowing what is wrong, and then heading for those things that are right and avoiding the bad things. And then eventually, yoniso manasikara, when you come to the very high ends of the path, like, you know, you come towards the awakening stages, there, of course, too, yoniso manasikara is foundational, right? You turn your mind to understand reality as it actually is. And when you make that turn of the mind, that itself is also yoniso manasikara. So this very important thing that you always carry with you on the path. So very useful to have some clarity about what that means. So this is the cause for sampajanya or sati sampajanya, clear comprehension, full awareness. So as I said, full awareness is about understanding the purpose, right? Whether you are heading in the right direction or not. Now, you have to think wisely to understand the purpose. You have to have some sense about what is right and wrong in the world. You have to have some sense of where you're going. Otherwise, clear comprehension becomes impossible. So this, again, mindfulness here is not the important aspect. The important aspect here is sampajanya, I think. So yoniso manasikara leads naturally to a sense of clarity about purpose and suitability of what you are doing here, because you understand, you have that sense of direction in your life. So then we come to the next factor. What is then the nutriment for careless attention? And it says here, lack of faith, lack of confidence. Right? Lack of faith is the nutriment for careless attention. And I don't know, I find that quite interesting, because usually when we talk about yona soma nasikara, we call it perhaps wise reflection or wise attention. And when we think about wisdom, we think about something which is an aspect of us, right? I am wise, or you are wise, or they are wise, or whatever, is part of your psychology, part of who you are as a human being. Either you're wise or you're not, or you're in between or whatever. Or maybe super wise or whatever. Maybe you're a wise guy, is that another possibility? But so it is. We see this as something inherent to us. Maybe not inherent, but something which is there. Either you have this quality or you have it not. But here, what it is saying, completely contrary to that idea, is that it comes from faith, right? It is confidence in a certain teaching that actually gives rise to that yoni soma nisikara. And this is fascinating. And the point, of course, here is that you have to start somewhere. And where we start is that the Buddha, in the beginning, tells us, he gives us some hints, he gives us some ideas about where to look, how to think about things, how to think wisely. And it is from confidence in what the Buddha says that we start to look in the right place. I'm sure you know what I mean, right? That's why you come here, for goodness sake, right? To be given some directions where to look, where not to look. So the fact that you have that confidence in these teachings in the first place is what allows you then to have yoni soma nisikara afterwards. The Buddha tells us, look here, don't look at that. Perceive in this way, don't perceive like that. Think like this, don't think like that. And as you do that, you're actually practicing yoni soma nisikara based on confidence. And then as time goes by and this starts to sink in, and you start to understand what is going on, why it works, it starts to become your own wisdom after a while. But most of us are kind of in an in-between land, right? There's some degree of our own wisdom, there's some degree of just confidence and faith, and both of those things go together. And as time goes by, you might think the faith goes up and the confidence goes down. No, both of them rise together. Both confidence and faith. This is kind of the nice thing about the Buddha's teaching, is that confidence or faith is a flip side of wisdom or understanding. The more wise you are, the more confidence you have. It is not blind. We're not talking about blind faith in Buddhism. We're talking about faith that is based on understanding, based on reality, a completely different type of faith. And because of that, they go together. And that is why when you become a stream enter, when you see the Dhamma and you understand with wisdom what's going on for the first time, that's when your confidence becomes settled. It becomes firm. It becomes unshakable, immovable. Right? Confidence and wisdom going together. These are not opposite sides in Buddhism. They're two sides of the same faculty. And they kind of grow together in this way. So that's why we here have confidence being the nutriment for wise attention. That confidence is what gives you the opportunity to grow this. Perhaps a little bit counterintuitive, and for that reason, I think quite interesting. The most interesting things in life are always the counterintuitive ones, right? That makes you think and makes you look at things in a new way. So, please. Yeah.
So, what if you have confidence in something opposite to
you? You have a problem, right? That's when you have a problem.
I have a confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem. Yeah. Right? So no, exactly. Of course, this is what happens, right? So this is the problem with having wrong view, is that you can't, you know, if you really have wrong view, how are you going to persuade them to get wrong view? You can't, very often you can't. And so sometimes you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, okay, do your thing, you know, if that's what you want to do, what can I say? But very often, if you are gentle and kind of do things in the right way, people often get persuaded in the long run. That's what I have experienced in my own life. People are often persuadable. You just have to be skillful and you have to be kind of careful in how you do things. But that exactly is the whole point. It's a trap, right? Delusion, ignorance, avidya is a trap because you don't know that you have delusion. Delusion is why it's so sticky and so hard to get out of. You are deluded. If you believe in God and you're absolutely sure God is out there kind of looking after you, it's very comforting, right? God is looking after me. Okay, no problems. It's comforting, but it might be wrong here. So what if it is wrong? What are the consequences of that? And the consequences from a Buddhist point of view, if you hold on to that idea firmly, you can go a long way on this path, but you can't go all the way to the end because you're holding on to something which is contrary to the path. So that is a serious problem. So sometimes, and this is one of the reasons why the Buddha says, you know, if you are on the right track, you have to use that opportunity here, because next life you might be on the wrong track again. We've all been there, right? Being deluded, being completely out of it. We probably all believed firmly in God in some past life, because we're all pretty much the same, right? We're not really any better than the people out there or people in different. We were just kind of moving around with different beliefs. One lifetime they are Buddhist, another lifetime we are Buddhist, and we are Christian, they are Christian. Kind of, you know, things just moving like that. So it's not. This is not a bad kind of judging people in a way. It's just more about just understanding that delusion is a very powerful force. And then to take the opportunity. If you feel that in this life you have some clarity, use that clarity to the max to get you out of this problem. Because now you have the chance. Yeah. So that's what I would say would be a good way of looking at that. You okay with that? Sort of. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is in some ways the same thing, you know. But the thing is that what I'm saying is that we have to assume that we are right, right? You have to assume that you're on the right track by practicing this. If you didn't assume that, you wouldn't be here. Huh? So you have to have some assumption, but be careful with that assumption. Be humble about it. Okay, you assume that we're on the right track, but you also know at the same time, even though you come here, you're not free of delusion. There are things in there which you misunderstand, right? So how much do you actually know? And that is where you have to, it's very, very, very useful to be humble about these things. And as far as we're concerned, maybe the fundamentalist Christians are right. They could be right. Until you know the truth in a profound sense for yourself, you don't actually know what's going on. And that is the beautiful thing about this. In Buddhism, you are allowed to say, I don't know. I am not sure, 100% sure, but this seems right to me, so I will follow this path, right? And I think that is a very important attitude. I don't think we should have in Buddhism the attitude, I know it all, this is the truth, everything else is wrong. If you have that attitude, then you're not being honest with yourself and what you actually know. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Why is that counterintuitive? I mean...
Yeah,
I missed that point. Yeah. I thought it was intuitive.
I think it is once you get it. So
it
if
was either, yeah, either yeah. you don't kowtow to the Buddha yeah. and miss it the whole point, or you miss the big boat.
Sure, I think it's just counterintuitive, because if we usually translate yoniso manasikara as wise attention, usually we think of wisdom as something which comes from us, right? So, but actually here it's coming from the Buddha. The Buddha is telling us. So it is wisdom, but it's actually drawn from the inside. It's not drawn from inside of yourself. So there's two sources of wisdom, coming from the outside or coming from inside of yourself. Yeah.
I mean the. I thought the biggest miracle here is the singularity, right? That the Buddha arises.
Yeah.
Or the past Buddha arises.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the biggest miracle.
Yeah. Sure. Yes, and we will see that in a second, that is the foundation for the whole path, right? That is where everything comes from, precisely. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So what then is the cause of this faith or confidence? And the answer is, or lack of faith rather, the answer is not hearing the good Dhamma. Right? So you have to hear the good Dhamma. Then you have, it gives rise to faith. So, what is this good Dhamma? And the good Dhamma, from a Buddhist point of view, is the Dhamma, right? The teaching of the Buddha, not some other kind of teaching, but the teaching of the Buddha. So you can see here that the word, when we talk about faith here and confidence, it matters that we have confidence in the right thing. It has to be a teaching that actually goes towards awakening, that takes you all the way, that doesn't kind of stop halfway. There may be other teachings that can take you a long way, but from a Buddhist point of view, you have to be able to penetrate, you know, non-self and these foundational things to be able to go all the way. So it is significant, it is important that we kind of put place our faith in the right place. It's kind of scary, right? We're fumbling around in the dark. We're kind of deluded. We know that. Sometimes we feel deluded. And yet we have to make this choice about what path to follow, and we don't really know. All we can really do is to make the best possible judgment from a variety of factors, from the people around you, from the coherence of the suttas, how they work. And I must admit, as far as scriptures are concerned, there's something about the Buddhist scriptures that are very powerful compared to at least some of the other scriptures that I have read. And also the quality of the people is also very high. Hear the good Dhamma. When you hear the good Dhamma, you recognize something, right? You recognize some truth in there. You have the faculties to be able to recognize the truth. And because of that, you then gives rise to confidence. Now, there's something very important about this, because one of the things I think is most difficult on the Buddhist path is not to understand the teaching. The teachings are quite simple, really, right? Be kind, do the right thing, practicing the right way, get rid of the hindrances, give rise to samadhi, right? The bliss and unification of mind and all of these kind of things. To understand what's going on is fairly simple. What is hard, the most difficult thing, is to have the perseverance and the commitment to actually fulfill it day after day, week after week, for your whole life, to maximize the opportunity, moment after moment. This, I think, is the most difficult thing on this path. So when we say difficult, it's difficult in a kind of very, not in a kind of intellectual way, but difficult in more like a ability to persevere with these things. And this tells you what you need to do, right, to persevere. Having that, the stronger your confidence is, the more you were able to persevere and commit yourself. And that confidence comes from hearing the true Dhamma. So this is where it's at, right? You need to kind of gradually brainwash yourself, gradually clean out all the stuff in there which is no good, and put some good stuff in there. Get the Buddha's washing powder and use that to wash out your brain and get a good brainwashing. And of course, the washing powder is reading the suttas and reflecting on them, understanding whatever other good teachings there are, and applying those in your life. So it's a very powerful thing, right? Here we're coming towards the very beginning of this whole sequence of factors. And it tells you at this beginning, what we are really dealing with is hearing the word of the Buddha is one of the most foundational things. And for that reason, of course, it is no surprise that the cause for hearing the good Dhamma is seeing the superior people. Is that the translation here? Good persons, it has here, elsewhere translated as superior people, the Sapurisa. And the Sapurisas, of course, are the Aryans, the noble people who have penetrated and understood that truth for themselves. Right? And that here is the foundation of this whole thing. That is what leads, the lack of seeing those people is what leads in the end to avidya, leads to the problems. And of course the opposite is seeing these people, then leads to the exact opposite. It leads to the liberation and freedom at the end. And it reinforces this very powerful message that without somebody having understood these things in the world, without somebody having seen this, just like Hu Tong was saying just a second ago, that this is the thing which makes the whole path become possible. This is the light arising in the world, which gives eyesight to everybody else. And without that, there is no walking down the path at all. Without that, there is no sense of confidence in the right teachings. So this is the basis, right? And what that means is that, again, what we have to do if we want to make progress on this path. We have to nurture those roots. Remember, we're talking about nutriments here. Every factor is the nutriment for the following one. And with every factor that you, and if we go back to the very root factor, you need to keep watering that root factor. You need to keep making it grow. You need to establish it more firmly. Right? Seeing the saparisas, read, understanding the suttas, these are the two things that go together. If you ever feel confused, if you ever feel uncertain, if you need a boost in your practice, that is where you go, and that will give you that boost. And this is very similar to this very famous saying that Buddha is very often quoted as saying that to Venerable Ananda, that the seeing, the Kalyanamitta, is 100% of the spiritual life. Ananda says to the Buddha, it's 50%. The Buddha says, no, Ananda, it's 100%, right? And I always thought, well, this must be some kind of exaggeration, right? Surely it's not 100%. There's all these other factors. You know, you have to be kind and generous and all these things. You have to be compassionate to people and all these things. The Buddha is just exaggerating. But it's not really the Buddha's way. He doesn't really exaggerate. When he says something like that, it has a very specific meaning. And the specific meaning is that you need that input at the beginning to get started. Without that input, there is nothing. It doesn't even get started. You don't go anywhere. And then you keep on getting that input again and again and again. And as you do that, this brainwashing happens, right? You may think brainwashing is bad. Brainwashing is good. It depends how you're brainwashed. You can be brainwashed. You get brainwashed anyway. Brainwashed just means conditioning. So you go out into the world, you meet all these people of various types. Brainwashing is a reality. Can't avoid that. Just have to make sure you get the right soap powder and the right kind of washing. Right? A good washing machine. And then you get put yourself in there, close the door, and take a few, tumble around a few times, and come out the other end, and then you're enlightened. So that is the... that is it. The reality is that you are brainwashed regardless. You have no choice about that. So you have to find the good brainwashing. And so you have to hope that you have some innate wisdom to be able to pick out that good brainwashing. And if you have that, then you are on the right track. So always think, always remember that these are the core, these are the, this is the source, the kind of root nutriment of everything else. So keep on getting excited about the suttas. They're such wonderful teachings. Once you get into them and you start to understand what's going on, wow, it is so beautiful and so powerful. Come here and listen to Ajahn Brahm on the Friday night talks, right? You are very much in the presence of the Dhamma when you are in the presence of somebody like Ajahn Brahm. And when you do that, it will gradually lift you up. It will change your view. You will become more and more aligned with the suttas, more and more aligned with the Buddha's vision of the world. And as you do that, you will make much more progress on the path. And it's all for your own happiness, all for your own freedom, liberation, independence, feeling of, wow, what a wonderful thing it is, this Dhamma. I feel so much better now than I did last year, last month, 10 years ago, two lifetimes ago, whatever it is, right? You're heading in the right way, and it feels so nice. So that is the core of the thing. This is the kind of foundational work we have to put in. And it's actually quite nice, right? It's quite nice to come here to Dhammaloka Center, hang out with your good friends, right? All these virtuous people doing the right thing, doing kind things, reading these amazing suttas, feeling inspired. I mean, what could be bad about that? Such a wonderful thing to do. You don't really have to... well, often we think about the Buddhist path, oh, I have to strive so hard, right? Grit my teeth and clench my fists or whatever. But no, it's not about that. The root causes are just coming here, hanging out with good people, listening to good teachings, and enjoying yourself, making it a happy path. One of those really important things, I think, in any Buddhist life is to make it enjoyable, because you're going to have to persevere for a long, long period of time. You have to enjoy what you're doing. And when you enjoy it, what you're doing, then perseverance will come. Make it into a exercise in torture and self-torment. There's no way that you're going to be able to persevere as a consequence. That is one, to me, is one of those really uplifting messages of this sutta, is that really all you have to do is keep on reading those suttas, and the motivation to practice will come from that. okay, sometimes you have to use a little bit of force. Sometimes you have to say, okay, get your act together, do the right thing. Of course, it is not. Nothing is completely automatic. But a lot of the time, it's just about getting back to these things, getting inspired, feeling, wow, I really want to take every opportunity in the day to do good things, to say right words, to think kind thoughts. And when you get into that mood, you really want to do that, wow, it becomes easy, it becomes nice, it becomes pleasant. You feel good about yourself, and everything goes so smoothly as a consequence. Yes, John. Yes. Yes, that's also like seeing the Noble One, right? In one sense, you're kind of seeing, you're in the presence of the Buddha in a way when you see the suttas. But I agree with you. I think that is a problem. Because obviously when you see a living example, it tends to be much more powerful than when you're just reading stuff. It's a bit more dry. So I think it is very, very useful to see living examples. So what we need to do is make more Noble Ones. So please practice hard, John. We get some more Noble Ones. That would be great, right? And then we become a blessing for the rest of the world because we also have penetrated those things. Okay, so I'll read one more paragraph, and then I will, unfortunately, I have to go because in 5 minutes because I have another appointment afterwards. But we can continue the sutta next time I'm here at Dhammaloka. It probably won't be that long in the future, and we can continue it then. But this is kind of nice because it's sort of halfway through this thing. So let me just do one little paragraph. It's a fairly quick one. Maybe I was being a bit... I think I will stop there because I realize it's a bit more than I had maybe bargained for. So let us stop there for today, because otherwise it would be a problem. Any last minute questions? Is anyone who is completely, utterly confused, have no idea what I'm talking about, and wonders what's going on, or everybody reasonably happy? Most of you have been around a long time, and you know a lot about Dhamma already. Okay. Yes, Lynn, please. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's something that either it nourishes or it denourishes, right? And if it nourishes, it gives strength to the quality. And if it's not present, then it kind of weakens the other thing. Yeah, exactly. That's an important thing. Good. Okay, everybody happy? Great. Let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.